I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's very special edition of Headliners. It's nice to see so many of our loyal subscribers and participants in the audience tonight, as well as those of you who may be joining us for the first time. In particular, I'd like to welcome Amit Garg, an international fellow at the Humphrey Institute visiting this year from India, and also Joan Mondale, one of our country's leading arts advocates. Mrs. Mondale, thank you for joining us tonight. Thank you. We're so glad you're here. For those of you who are new to Headliners, this is a monthly forum for engaged citizens interested in discussing topical issues with university faculty and community leaders. Tonight, it's a particular pleasure to welcome both one of the university's most distinguished professors as well as Minnesota's most legendary public figures. Each spring for the past 3 years, former Vice President Walter Mondale and political science professor Larry Jacobs have taught an undergraduate course on national security issues. Truly a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for students to learn American history, political history, and policy from a firsthand perspective. This year, for the first time, we were able to offer you the opportunity to audit this unique course, and I'm told that many of you responded to this offer. Hope it's going well. But for those of us who weren't able to commit to the early morning weekly sessions, we're happy to share a sample of this unique classroom experience this evening. University of Minnesota Professor Larry Jacobs holds the Walter and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Studies and directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Humphrey Institute for Public Affairs. An expert in American politics and healthcare policy. In fact, you may recall that he opened this year's headliner season with a prescient discussion of the healthcare debate that predicted actually the current stalemate that we're in. Larry, way to go. My money was on whatever you predicted. Professor Jacobs is the author of 10 books, including three, I don't believe this, that were just published by the University of Chicago Press. These new books include Talking Together, Public Deliberation and Political Participation in America, which focuses on the importance of public discourse, a belief that Larry puts into regular practice. He serves as a political analyst for local media, including WCCO-TV, Minnesota Public Radio, Twin Cities Public Television, and has made numerous presentations at the National Press Club. Walter Mondale has been a pivotal figure in American politics since 1948. He received a law degree from the University of Minnesota and was a practicing lawyer in Minneapolis when Governor Orville Freeman appointed him to his first of two terms as Minnesota State Attorney General. He served as U.S. Senator from Minnesota for 12 years, and in 1976, as we remember, was elected the 42nd Vice President of the United States. In 1984, he was the Democratic nominee for president, and from 1993 to 96, he served as the ambassador to Japan. Mr. Mondale devoted much of his public service to U.S. foreign policy and to balancing national security with the country's constitution. He's the author of the book, The Accountability of Power, Toward a Responsible Presidency, and he continues to practice law, teach, and write. Please join me in a warm welcome for Professor Larry Jacobs and Vice President Walter Mondale.
Great to be here. Thank you very much. We thought we would talk a bit about some of the themes in our course that we've been teaching. We started off teaching a course 4 years ago that was, a culling of students at the University of Minnesota, mostly graduate students from the law school, from political science, sociology, the Humphrey Institute, that was focused on looking at documents from the National Security Council that Mr. Mondale and I persevered and were able to get released It was really an extraordinary class. Each of the students took on a project, things like what had been the top secret minutes of Vice President Mondale's meeting with the Chinese leadership. We had actually a student from China who did that. Some students worked on Mr. Mondale's opening with South Africa. If you're interested in what peaceful regime change looks like, here was the beginning of it, and it's extraordinary. During the trip to Atlanta, Mr. Mondale gave a speech at the Carter Center, and Nelson Mandela's granddaughter walked in beforehand and went up and hugged Vice President Mondale. And while I'm accustomed to that sort of expression of warmth, I did wonder who this was. And later I asked Mr. Mondale, who was that? He said, oh, you know. And he explained it to me, and he said, well, from Nelson Mandela's family, they think of me as, you know, one of the people who really began the thaw. And now that you go through these top secret documents, you can see why. There was a real battle about giving the message to the apartheid government in South Africa that this would end, it would be a peaceful regime change, but that the United States was no longer going to support apartheid. Now, in the last 3 years, we've been teaching a course that's really geared primarily to undergraduates. And what Mr. Mondale wanted to do was to give undergraduates the opportunity to take a kind of a gateway course. What are the big themes in American politics? And so we've put together this course. We usually have about 200 students in it. I like to say it's the good news and bad news for me. It's the height of my teaching experience. The bad news is I've got 20 years left. And it's all downhill from here. In any case, we thought we would talk a little bit about some of the themes in this course. They're both historical and contemporary. Mr. Mondale, would you like to start out maybe talking about some of the broader themes, and we can get into some of the more detailed issues?
Yeah, thank you, Larry. And Mary Nichols, thank you so much. I always like coming here, so Mary introduces me, and I look forward to it because I love exaggeration. And I thought tonight we'd be alone with this weather, but here you are, and I'm very grateful to you for coming, and thank you, Larry, for your leadership at the Humphrey Institute and for your scholarship that's so important to all of us. We're going to talk about the presidency in the Constitution in the post-war era and up to now, if your questions lead us there. It is a central question today and has been through most of American history. When our nation was founded, when our Constitution was created, our founders, I think, figured out, above all, how human nature worked. And they said in the Federalist Papers, in a nice way, that the human being system is flawed. We are not angels. And therefore, beware of unaccountable power, unchecked power. They really looked at the possibilities of tyranny coming out of our own government as a greater risk than those from a foreign power. And so they went to work and created this unique constitution. It had some flaws and some scandals in it, like slavery. But the idea of checks and balances, of what they said, pitting ambition against ambition, of establishing the legislative branch, the Congress, with specific powers, real powers, for example, over appropriations, over treaty making power, the power of congressional oversight, the power to override presidential vetoes, that you can just see them game planning the kinds of fights that would break out between a president and the Congress, and arming the Congress with the tools to make it an even fight. And similarly, they shaped the presidency and then, of course, created the separate court system. Since that time, almost from the first day, beginning with George Washington, these fights have broken out. And they have continued in one way or another, one form or another, throughout our history. I believe that they were exactly right. I believe that power must be checked. It must be held accountable. I believe that our nation has prospered and grown and advanced because we are an open, accountable society where each of us can learn and where we have something to say about our government and what it's going to do. It's not an easy task, because one of the defenses that the executive uses seemingly with every administration, is arguments that they're defending America's from foreign powers, from enemies, which they are. And because of that, they need to have extra powers, unappealable powers, that allow them to do for us what no one else can do. So there's this struggle, this tussle over whether the president is trying to claim for himself imperial powers, whether he's acting within the expected scope of the president, what are the natures of the challenges, and all the rest. That's what our course is about, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Mondale. Folks who know you, the public part, may not fully appreciate the very detailed and sustained and really thoughtful work that you've done in building institutions. When you were the youngest attorney general in America, in Minnesota's history, to that point, you went about creating a kind of consumer orientation in the attorney general's office that was then adopted around the country and is now one of the main themes. When you went to Congress, you were very devoted to that institution and were part of some of the big reforms. One of the reforms you were involved in was taking a hard look at the filibuster. Could you talk a little bit about the challenge that you faced in the filibuster, why you took it on, and what you think of the way the filibuster is being used today? Is the current use of the filibuster Madisonian in this kind of checking, or is it a total deviation?
Did you watch Lehrer tonight? Well, that was a question tonight. And it's a central question. When I was in the Senate, it required two-thirds, 67 votes in debate, if you can imagine that. And it was always used on civil rights issues. Whenever you wanted to pass a civil rights act, the South would gather together. And until the mid-60s, we weren't able to get the two-thirds needed. And then the guy named Jim Allen from Alabama and some others just started using the filibuster on almost everything. And they were very skillful, gifted parliamentarians, and they could tie the Senate in knots. They could spend a week reading the morning prayer and amending the words in it and then submitting it for a vote and that sort of thing. And even after you get a filibuster, the cloture invoked and you're supposed to vote on the measure, they figured out a way of keeping a filibuster going forever after the cloture had been. So we were in, I thought, a crisis where our country could not do its business. And so I led the fight with some friends to reduce the filibuster from 67 to 60. And we were on the floor for almost a month fighting over it, and we finally got it passed. And the way we did it was to argue, accurately I think, that the Constitution of the United States vests the Congress with the power to set its own rules. And I argued that that being true, a majority at the beginning of a session has the power to establish its own rules. So on two or three occasions, I won't go into the parliamentary fight, but we got the Senate in the position where it either had to compromise or it had to accept the decision that a majority could change the rules. and they decided to compromise. And so they came to 60. And I thought that would do it. I thought that, and I believe some ability to slow down, to demand compromise, has been good for the country. Too much paralyzes it, but every once in a while, the country has to open up an issue like the Vietnam War when I was there, or other things that would just, the country just had to stop and think about it. And the Senate is uniquely able to do that. I think we're at a crisis again. If you watch, nothing's going to pass that 41 senators don't want. And so we're now in a position where the margin of the Senate is the highest it's been in 30 years. We still can't get anything done. Now, you can always hope that reason will prevail and sensible things will happen. And it has happened there occasionally. But right now, it looks like a train wreck to me. And we've got all these important things to get done. We may not get them all done, but we're paralyzed now. And I'm hoping that either something will break where they start getting along together, or they can go back at that rule. I think that rule has to be looked at again.
Thank you, Mr. Mondale. You've devoted your career to this Madisonian idea, and I think you can see what I see often, which is the search for balance.
Yeah.
Mr. Mondale often will talk about that you respect the motives, you try to respect even those you disagree with, they're not your enemy, they're people who hold different values and perspectives. And that's clearly helped to guide you into the leadership post that you have. And yet, there was a new interpretation of the Constitution that those of us in the scholarly world started to see in the 90s, and actually had its roots back even further in, around the debate on Richard Nixon's powers. And it really came to the fore during George W. Bush's presidency. And one of the key figures there was Vice President Cheney. Vice President Cheney, before he was vice president, had been a member of Congress and was a leader of a group that sat on the congressional investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal during the Reagan administration. And Cheney helped to write a minority report. And in that minority report, you begin to see the outlines of what we now know as a unitary view of the president, presidential power. And in it, Cheney complained that Congress was engaging in what he described as an aggrandizing theory of Congress's foreign policy powers. And he went on to argue, quote, "Congress must recognize that an effective foreign policy requires, and the Constitution mandates, the president to be the country's foreign policy leader." How do you evaluate that kind of argument?
I think the Constitution contemplates a strong president, but a president that shares power with the Congress as defined by the Constitution. And that's where Mr. Cheney had read the Constitution differently than I did. Still does. His idea was that the president was almost, well, he used the word imperial once. Almost, when it comes to national security, when it comes to dealing with circumstances abroad, the president is it. And the president doesn't have to answer congressional questions. And before he got through with that theory, while he was in power, I think he stretched it to extremes we haven't seen before in American history. We have the Geneva Accords, which prohibits America from resorting to torture. He thought the president didn't have to comply with that. There's a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in being that was passed during the church hearing days after Vietnam or during Vietnam that set up a system where the president could do what he had to do to protect us through the FBI, the CIA, and the other things you have to do to deal with our adversaries and enemies, but required that he take steps that interfered with Americans' legal rights to a secret court, the FISA court. It's a federal bench, but it operates in secret. So they had to get a warrant for things where they were violating an American's rights. And it also set up a Senate and a House Intelligence Committee, the ones that are there, and the executive branch had to report to the Congress. The idea of checking presidential, letting them become be powerful as they must be, but keeping a check on it. Mr. Cheney didn't agree with that. And he, even though the law was there and the president took an oath to uphold the law, this is one he decided they didn't have to listen to. So they didn't report anything they didn't want to report to the Congress. They just went around the FISA court, and they started a system of just checking on people as they saw fit. Total awareness, they called it.
You were, when you were in Congress, as a senator, you wrote a book called The Accountability of Power. And you served on, maybe the most significant government investigation of itself in our history. It's known as the Church Committee. We had out for our first or second class F.A.O. Schwartz, Jr., who was a legal counsel for that, and he said that you were the leader, you know, of that committee, particularly after Frank Church was looking into running for president. Now, when folks look at Vice President Cheney's arguments, they're scary. He basically says, look, do you want to be safe or do you not want to be safe? If you want to be safe, we can't get around, you know, worrying about these small constitutional questions. Trust us, we're going to keep you safe. Now, in the investigations you did at the Church Committee, what did you discover that would lead you to be skeptical of this kind of assurance?
Well, this is ancient history now, but all of it has been reported. Under J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI and under leadership at the CIA and with the support of more than one president of both political parties, these institutions intruded in the lives of Americans in ways that clearly violated the law. Checked people's tax returns, 300,000 or 400,000 of them. You know, dangerous people like Arthur Burns and Hubert Humphrey and so on, they were checking their tax returns. This was not for law abiding, this is for checking to see if they were subversive or not. They opened people's mail. They had agents, people in the military, and going to all kinds of meetings. Anything that was like the women's movement bothered them. And the environmental movement troubled them greatly. And they were, we actually had a civil rights rally out in front of the Capitol steps in the state capitol, one of the first was ever there. And I found out later when I looked at my file, about a third of the audience were FBI agents listening to us. And Hoover believed that King was what he called a black hate leader. He was a man who was dangerous to America, and he wanted to, quote, knock him off his pedestal. And he carried out a vendetta against Martin Luther King, secretly and privately. And at one point, they sent a letter to King pressing him to commit suicide because he was, this is all on the record, I'm not exaggerating at all. And what you saw was private agencies essential, so essential for us, but had gotten loose from rational moorings and from the idea that they're there to enforce the law. They were doing something else. And controlled by people that Hoover had been there way too long, and he was seeing things. And so we came up with this report. Many things happened overseas as well, but we came up with this report that showed that this was hurting American security. This was undermining the American system of liberty. and that there is a balance between security and liberty. And you need them both to have either. And that is that has changed. That particular set of hearings, and what I was the chairman of the domestic side, and we got inside of records. We talked to people and had witnesses. We saw a complete picture like has never been seen before about what was going on then. And we passed laws that I talked about a little earlier here to try to prevent that from recurring again while keeping these agencies strong.
Thank you. Every now and then you see a story in the paper. I've got my little collection here of what strikes me as maybe the outlines of the need for kind of another church committee. And you've seen others kind of talking about that. And some of the stories here, these in the New York Times just in the last few months. One is on from the Inspector General of the Justice Department, which is a very important position, talking about the fact that there were more than 3,500 telephone accounts that were being listened in on, including several reporters who were being investigated in connection with a leak. Now, there was no leak. There was no FISA warrants for this. Just the FBI going ahead with it. Here's a story closer to home that's about related to the Minneapolis Somali community and the FBI concerns about what they see as a possible terrorist connection. And it goes on to talk about this is the second paragraph. Instead of collecting information only on people about whom they had a tip or links to teenagers, agents fanned out to scrutinize the entire Somali community. And it goes on to talk about what some in the Somali community here see as efforts to instigate. Do you have concerns that we may be slipping back into old patterns?
Let me say a couple things. First of all, we need an FBI. We need a CIA. We need people. There are dangers around. There are threats to us that need to be dealt with, but there are the laws and there are the systems that I'm confident can make this handled within the law. What I'm worried about is for some years the controls just slipped away, and technology is allowing things to be done now that you couldn't have done. When we did our hearings, we had the landline telephone. You remember that? And now, and they would pick up conversations through the air, the intercepts, the big intercept stations, and try to follow things that way. Now almost everything is in fiber optic cable, and everything is digitalized. And now, your telephone calls, your emails, your YouTubes, your memos, the pictures of your family, everything that you send, transmit it all, ends up in these enormous gigabytes or whatever, parcels of almost unlimited bundles of communications. And they're moving along at the speed of sound, I guess. And you might make a call from Minneapolis to St. Paul, and it might be routed through London, or it might be routed through San Francisco, the big stations, communication stations. And they have developed ways, if you read the book, The Shadow Factory, one of the experts, they've developed ways of being able to tap into these gushers of data that go bellowing through these systems and pull out what they think is necessary. And they pull out, I don't think we know what they're doing now. And a lot of people I talk to in Washington don't think they know. I think we need another church-type committee to look into whether we've lost our balance here, whether we're doing what is necessary, but doing more than is necessary. You know, I would like that committee to look into a lot of things. I mean, how did we get into this war in Iraq? How was that case made? How did we decide on torture? I think there's a black hole in our history in recent years, and it would be good for us if we got that out and on the record so we could understand what happened, and then as citizens, we can try to prevent it from happening again.
Mr. Bonda, just to be clear and to avoid any confusion, what you're talking about, does this involve prosecutions, or is this kind of an effort to throw some people in jail? Or, I mean, what are we talking about here?
I was never very hot on prosecuting people, although some of them might be prosecuted. I was more interested in finding out and making public what had happened so we could shape laws that restored balance and we could move on and do what we had to do as a nation. I think when you make it a prosecution system, you change the mood away from what I'm talking about to some kind of vindication or vindictiveness, and I don't think the public wants that.
And I think, you know, just looking at the history, the church committee it's kind of one of those icons. Mm-hmm. And you read the paper or you read the stories that I'm referring to, the church committee is, you know, the fountainhead. You know, yeah. Like the church committee or you know, as we know from the church committee. And, you know, if we had prosecuted and put people in jail, and some did go to jail, you know, that fades with time. But what you found and the core message there, that abuses were happening by our government that made us weaker and violated our rights, that endures.
Yeah, and I think it did make us weaker. I think that the torture camps, Abu Ghraib and the others, Guantanamo, I think that hurt America and undermined our stature and our strength in the world. And I think the connection between America's international reputation and our power and our strength, that's a real connection. I was ambassador for those 4 years in Japan, and although you can't count it in terms of numbers or bombs or anything, America's stature allowed us to do things with Japan because they respected us and we respected them. That is a precious element in American power. And I think we lost that through through torture, through the contempt for the Geneva Accords, through the, you know, this strutting around saying we were only going to listen to have allies of the willing, and we really hurt ourselves. I'd say this, before Bush was done, I think he saw that, and he started changing policies when he changed, put in Gates for Rumsfeld. He was starting to change course. Cheney didn't change, but I think the administration was changing.
Thank you. In our course, we go back over the course of quite a bit of post-World War II history. We're not just talking about Republican presidents. We dig in on the Democratic administrations as well. And one of the cases we look at, and I know you consider it to be pretty important, was when Harry Truman, as president, seized the steel mills. Now, Truman thought this was absolutely essential. You know, it's the usual story of the emergency. Our troops are in combat, active combat, critical point in the Korean War. A strike is breaking out or about to break out. He seizes the steel mills. What's the lesson in that episode?
Truman, as president, was involved, I think by this time, in the Korean War. This steel strike occurred. He thought it undermined his ability to conduct war, and he thought within his presidential powers there must be a capacity to end that strike. So he ordered the steel mills taken over by the government and ordered the strike ended. And, of course, that went to the courts immediately, and the Supreme Court ruled, no, Mr. President, you don't have that power. There's no authority in the Constitution or in the laws of this country that empower a president to seize, to do what you did. And that was the case where I think Justice Jackson made that famous three-step analysis. He said presidential power is at its maximum where the Congress has adopted legislation that authorizes what the president is doing. And the president is in the middle in cases where the law is silent. And the president is in his weakest condition to claim power when what he's trying to do is contrary to what the law allows or prohibits what he wants to do. And that standard, I think, is a pretty good rule of thumb. And in this case, Truman had nothing to point to.
And that helps to explain your argument about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, because there you had President Bush saying, this is hamstringing me, and you had a number of senators, including Senator Feinstein, saying, tell us how. We'll revise it. We'll reform it. And there you had a president going it alone in opposition to established statute that you had helped to pass and formulate, and he was forced to retreat. Do you think when presidents go it alone in the hope to build their power, it backfires on them?
Well, you know, I was there. That's pretty intoxicating. And the ability to handle power like a president can, legitimately, is quite awesome. And with just a little bit of luck, a president starts inhaling that. And the idea of use of secret power is really a grant of power to the president. Because if it's secret, then it's unaccountable. If it's secret, you don't have to tell the Congress. You don't have to justify what you've done, because in theory, nobody will hear about it. They always talk about plausible deniability. In other words, something happened and nobody did it. And so we've had cases of presidents who just went too far. Before Roosevelt took it most of the way, I was surprised to find out that at the 64 National Convention, Democratic Convention, Lyndon Johnson had ordered the FBI to follow Martin Luther King and others to find out what we were doing down there at the convention. There's been a lot of abuse of these agencies and powers under presidents of both political parties.
One of the you've worked with or been known met most of the presidents since World War II. One of those presidents was Richard Nixon, and obviously you were someone keeping a close eye on him in the Senate at that point. One of the elements of Richard Nixon's presidency was his claim of executive power and his refusal to share information with some of the congressional investigations. Do presidents deserve, should they be given executive power to keep their communications confidential and not even share them with the legislative branch?
I think a president needs secrecy. I think he needs to be able to talk to his key staff and others without having to get on the evening news with it. And I don't think that's the kind of secrecy we're talking about. We're talking about big things that that fundamentally violate the law or undermine the constitutional system of government. Nixon, in my opinion, was a an anomalous guy. He's brilliant. You look back, a lot of the things he did in the domestic field look pretty good today. He had the guts to go and try to get something started with China, something that we needed to do. The left couldn't have gotten that done. He did. And I remember in civil rights, he didn't agree with everything we did, but he wasn't bad on civil rights. But I think the man was paranoid. I think he had a thing. And he looked on his political opponents as enemies that had to be done away with, at least in the political sector. And so when you look at what he did with Watergate, if you read some of the latest books where you can read what he said to his friends and the stuff he wrote on that yellow pad, this was a man obsessed with demons, I believe. And that's what destroyed him. And that's what created the scandal that finally caused, first time and only time in American history, a president had to resign the presidency and leave in scandal. What an incredible moment in American history. You remember all this, but when they found out that he had kept tapes of every conversation that occurred in his Oval Office, and then he tried to suppress those tapes from being disclosed and erase the tapes so we won't know what 18 minutes of it was, and then he said, under secret executive privilege and because of national security, because the nation's in danger, I cannot disclose these tapes. Went up to the Supreme Court, most of whom, by the way, had been put on the court by Nixon. And they ruled, yes, there is executive privilege, but we, the court, will decide where that privilege applies and where it doesn't. And in this case, they didn't quite say it that, but we see a crime committed here, and the privilege does not apply to this case, and it drove Nixon out of the office.
It's a remarkable example of this balance that you've been talking mm-hmm. about between presidential power, but also the checking system. Yeah. In this episode around Nixon, one of the key figures in moving the country beyond what could have been an absolute, could have taken a momentary crisis yeah. and really been much worse, was Gerald Ford.
Yeah.
Now, you knew Gerald Ford, you worked with him. Could you give us a sense of how you sized up Ford and his role at that moment?
I think Ford really served his nation well as president. He wasn't there long, and as I recall, I campaigned against him. But he was honorable. He was trying to bring the country back together. He played it straight. And all these FISA laws I talked about earlier, these intelligence reforms and so on, he supported all of that. And matter of fact, he helped create a bipartisan support for all of those reforms. So I think he's got to go down in history as a decent and solid man and president.
This is one of the things that I've enjoyed most about having the privilege to teach with Mr. Mondale, is this generosity of spirit and balance.
Yeah.
And, you know, about Ford, there are a lot of, Democrats who would, you know, I think particularly in this moment, have a hard time acknowledging contributions where they are, but also the balance that you bring. And I'm just kind of ticking off the number of areas just in our conversation so far where we're faced with the Dick Cheney choice. You could have security or liberty, and your response is, that's a false choice. There are ways in which, through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and other measures, we can have both, or presidential powers or Madisonian checks, and your response is, we need presidential power, and we need a strong Congress and a strong judiciary. or the issue of executive privilege. Presidents need to have that, but we also need accountability.
Can I bring up executive privilege? The big case on that is U.S. versus Nixon, the tapes case I talked about. That's where they said, yes, there is a privilege, but it will be the courts independently deciding, not the president, where that line is. There's another strategy that presidents using, including President Obama, that I find unsettling, called the state secret argument. The case starts, and the U.S. lawyer stands up and says, we're not going to submit any evidence in this case because it's all a state secret. We can't tell you what it is. And many trials end right there because the court doesn't have anything to work with. There was one case where a person was picked up wrongly, sent to a country where he was tortured, came back and brought a lawsuit for damages, and this administration told the judge it was a state secret, couldn't get involved in it. There's cases involving this tapping of the fiber optic cables I talked about, where people have brought lawsuits claiming that they've been tapped contrary to the law and asking for damages. And the government has said, these are state secrets, and we can't let you look at any of this. That's a form of government secrecy from which there is no appeal. And I don't think it's good for the government, and I don't think it's right. I think, once again, you need balance. Pat Leahy's got a bill that I wish would pass that says that the state secret issue, if raised, will be determined just as executive privilege by the judge in secret, if necessary. But there will be an independent determination of whether the state secret issue is valid or not. And I think we need that, because right now it's a showstopper.
Well, on this topic of the current administration, the New York Times this fall had an editorial. This is not an op-ed. This is the editorial of the paper. And the title of it is, "The Cover-Up Continues." The Obama administration has clung for so long to the Bush administration's expansive claims of national security and executive power that it is in danger of turning George W. Bush's cover-up of abuses committed in the name of fighting terrorism into President Obama's cover-up. Is that a legitimate concern? Is it overstated?
I think there's a problem there. I wouldn't state it that strongly, but maybe I can go into just. I think that, you know, this is one where Obama really knows what he's doing. He's a former professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago. He was president of the Harvard Law Review. This isn't the second team when it comes to the law and what it means. And so when he... I've been watching this very carefully. When he tries to deal with the Bush precedents, most of which he campaigned against, these very areas we're talking about, he's done some things that I think he deserves credit for. He basically has ended all... he's ended all torture. He said, we're going to comply with the Geneva Accords, and we're not going to allow this. He said he's going to close Guantanamo. He's got some problems. I think he wants to close it. I think he made a mistake in saying he's going to close it by a date certain. They've got the problems with these Yemeni inmates down there. They don't dare send them back to Yemen. There's some problems there, I think. I think he wants to do the right thing, although we have to see how that plays out. The one place where I worry is the state secrets thing that we talked about. And I wish he would support the idea of a kind of a 9/11 commission to look into these issues and get a new update and fresh understanding of what is happening. So I would give him fairly good grades, but I'm worried about some of this.
Last month, Peter Baker had a remarkable article in the New York Times magazine, and in it, he talks about some of the similarities between the Bush administration and the Obama administration, starting off with the cast of characters look very familiar in some areas, where they're kind of fellow travelers in a sense. And then he goes through some of the policies, and he quotes a number of Bush administration officials, including one who said, it's really, really hard to find a difference that's meaningful and not atmospheric. Is that the Bush administration folks trying to kind of fudge over the differences, or?
He answers that in that article. I think that he's done some things that took a lot of guts. He released all of the private legal memos, the John Yoo memos, the torture memos. They were really mad at him for releasing that. He did release it. He's put, I think, good people in charge of the Justice Department. And I think there's a different tone on this. But Guantanamo is still there. They're still not answering a lot of public questions. He's raising the state secret defense. A couple of times he's written a signing statement that which I don't like. And I don't think it's fair to say he's put poor people in there. I think I'd give him a B. And one of the problems of the president gets into, and it is that there is a problem with terrorists. They may be, we don't know what the hell they're doing. They could be on their way right now. And we've got to try to stay on top of that. And I think the president is trying to keep in place things that he believes are essential to diminish the chance that they'll be successful. And I hope he'll draw a line which places the constitutional legal rights and of our citizenry and of our nation at the right level. I think he's struggling with that right now. If he did everything I wanted him to do, and there was a terrorist attack, I think it'd be they would really lay on him.
Thank you, sir. Gary Wills had a typically intelligent article in the New York Review of Books a few months ago. And in it, he says, the history of America since World War II has caused an inertial transfer of power toward the executive branch. You've been at this for a little while now. You've been involved and worked closely with all three branches as Attorney General with the Judiciary and then in the Senate and then obviously in the White House. What's your take on that? Do you view this as a kind of...
No, I thought that was a good article. And one of the reasons I'm always pressing for accountability, for disclosure, for definitions of the law that finally let the American people in on what's going on so they've got something to say about it, is that there are, we have, since the atomic bomb, the president now is in charge of the button. In the most important issue of human survival, he's the guy. The whole CIA, that's his shop. The National Security Agency, that's his shop. The FBI, that's his shop. And all across the government, there are agencies and specialists and power centers that report almost exclusively, when the final analysis, and privately to the president. That is heady stuff. And I think a kind of I think he called it a national state security state, where the emphasis on security, which we must have, is so pervasive and prevailing and bureaucratized within the government, that there is some momentum there that can push a president over the edge in what his constitutional limits are. And I think that's one of the reasons I always like to push on accountability. I'll tell you, this is an example. We were on the committee, Intelligence Committee, and a CIA agent had just been killed, assassinated in Athens. And the CIA said that our committee had released this guy's name and caused his death. And a very, very high public official came up in a secret session. I won't use his name, but you know him. And he said, your committee caused this information to be leaked, and an agent has been killed, and laid it right on our table. And I said, you realize we didn't have this guy's name, that we won't accept agents' names, that it couldn't come from us, that the agent's name had in fact leaked in the public long before this committee was established. You realize all that, don't you? They did know it, but they were using this to put pressure on Congress to stop. When we were in the early days of the Church Committee, we would receive very broad complaints from the head of the FBI and the others, people in the, Henry Kissinger hated us. And they would say, you know, you're weakening America. You're undermining our nation's strength. You should look into something else, not us. And the pressure would really get rough. And I'm confident we did the right thing, but the instinct, the tendency, in some ways the culture in Washington resists, it's sometimes even bitterly, the accountability that I think the Congress, the Constitution requires of its public officers. And so I think we should be careful of that.
It's a very wise statement. Well, maybe we can open things up for questions. I don't know if we have that ability. Okay, while Dean Nichols is doing that, let me ask you another question. When you look at this inertial shift towards the executive branch, you've talked about the importance of accountability and pushing back against that. Is this a kind of, do you view it as kind of pendulum swings where you get a Nixon or you get a Bush? Is it a kind of a slow accretion of kind of precedent upon precedent in which presidents kind of grab it?
I mean, I think it's both. I think the part of the government that deals with security, the nature of some of these threats, so this 9/11 stuff and so on, this really, I think, scares all of us, has contributed to this sense that the president has to be strong, and the president does have to be strong. And when something like that happens, I think those elements in our government tend to get the range of movement that they want. But then there's a cycle. You remember when World War II started? The first, I do. For the few of you here who do,
you're not going to ask for a show of hands, are you?
One of the first things we did was to round up every one of our fellow citizens who was Japanese and put them in jail, even though many of their kids were in the military fighting on our side, go for broke, and it was a shameful moment in American history, but we were scared. And this is the first thing we could think of. When World War I broke out in America, Minnesota set up a Minnesota Public Safety Commission, and it was designed to find disloyal German Minnesotans and remove them if they couldn't prove their loyalty from public office. We had this going in Minnesota. The case of Neer versus Minnesota came out of here. Trying to protect against it. It was a phony fear, but we had it. And in American history, it goes back and forth, back and forth. Alien Sedition Act, list is long.
Thank you. Maybe we can take some questions.
Yeah, before we do, though, I don't think we can exaggerate our appreciation for sharing this firsthand. Wow. What a treat this is to tap your wisdom and experience. And Larry, is he a pretty tough grader for those undergrads?
I wouldn't want to be graded by him.
I know the undergrads ask great questions, but this graduate office also has audience also asks terrific questions. Got one right,
Mary. We have one here on your right.
Okay, terrific. Over there, and then right back here.
Thank you very much. Could you say a little bit more about two subjects you touched on, the signing statements? It seems to me that's totally unconstitutional, and I didn't realize how much it's been practiced over time. And then how you think the filibuster rule should be changed if you were there? Thank you.
The signing statement as used by particularly Bush, who did 1,000 of them, I think, He would sign a bill like the law they passed against torture, John McCain's bill, and then at the same time he'd sign a letter that he'd file with the National Register that said he didn't agree with the bill, wouldn't comply with it, and thought it interfered with his constitutional rights. So the Constitution, I believe, anticipates if a president doesn't find a bill unacceptable, he vetoes it. And then it goes back to the Congress, and they decide whether they want to override him or not. And that's how it's settled. But with the signing statement, the president, in effect, says, I will decide myself, and the Congress won't get a second stab at this thing. So I think used that way is unconstitutional, and I wish we could find some way of dealing with it. I think just as we had to reduce the margin needed to gain cloture because we were in paralysis in mid-70s, we're paralyzed now, and we can't pass anything. And I think that we should reduce, we should do two or three things. We should do away with the hold. You know what the hold is? One senator can say, I don't want this nominee name to come up. Just one senator. And the Senate could want it? No. That's the holder. I don't want this bill to come up. One senator can do it. I don't see any legal, constitutional, or policy reason where one person should have that power. I also believe that the leadership ought to be able to call up bills without a filibuster. But for those matters that are filibustered, I'd like to see the number reduced to 58, or 56. That doesn't guarantee that things are going to pass, but I think it would put more movement into the Senate and make it more likely that they could have their debates, they could ventilate these issues, they could force compromise, but they finally would act. And I think we got to do something.
Well, Mr. Monda, just to follow up on that, you're an institutionalist and you're a student and a lover of the Senate. Do you worry at all that that kind of institutional reform would be used by the next Republican president, Republican Congress, which will be here at some point in the future?
That's the thing about the rules. They can be used by either side. My argument is that whatever the rulings, whatever the precedent, above it all stands the Constitution. And the Constitution says the Congress has the authority to shape its own rules. That's what binds, not one senator. And so I would like to use that authority, as I did when I was there, to make keep the rule, but change the numbers so the chances of action and movement improved.
Yes, really pleased to be here. But your comment about Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, you like Gerald Ford. I felt, personally, having lived through that, and also I remember the start of World War II, that Gerald Ford took away from us, the American people, the possibility of truly understanding what Richard Nixon did, because it never came to trial, never came to court. In my view, the guy should have gone to jail.
Yeah.
I'd like you to comment on that.
Well, you know, that's the one thing. I was very critical of that at the time. But I'll tell you, after watching this over the years, Nixon did pay a price. Nixon was humiliated, driven out of office. He didn't get off scot-free. And I think that if we had driven Nixon to a criminal trial at that time, I think there'd be millions of Americans who would never accept the legitimacy of that effort. So it was a tough call. I criticized at the time. With time, I believe he was probably right.
Mr. Mondale, I think you've told me this story, maybe I have it wrong, that when Hubert Humphrey's health was failing, that he insisted that Nixon be invited. Maybe you could explain what I'm trying to.
Well, you know, do any of you remember Humphrey? Well, Humphrey was soft on everybody. Nobody ever did anything wrong that wasn't to be pardoned. And in his later years, Nixon and Humphrey used to talk on the phone all the time. And when Humphrey's funeral occurred, Nixon was one of the first people to show up and to be there. It's funny how that worked.
And Humphrey invited him.
Yeah, he wanted to be there. Yeah.
We have a question over here now.
Oh. I'd like to ask you to comment on the Dutch decision. They did an inquiry into the Iraq War, and they found it to be illegal. I think it was about 2 weeks ago. And the British are also, they have an inquiry going at the moment, and I wondered if you would comment on those.
I read the story on the British report. They're looking into how the British government made the decision to support the United States in starting the war in Iraq, and I think Blair is taking a real pounding on that. And going into the secret developments, the private reports, and the rest, so that the British public can pass their own judgment on how, whether they thought they were told the truth and whether the right thing was done. We haven't done this in America, and I believe we should have a responsible 9/11 type commission to do that, because as I said earlier, there's a black hole. Why did we start that war? Why were we told what we were told about it? What did we know about that? I don't want to hang anybody, but that, I think that may be the biggest self-inflicted, profound mistake in America's history. And I think the American people have a right to find out what really happened.
Mr. Monda, you're... Your former colleague and friend, Senator Pat Leahy, has proposed, I think he's calling it a truth commission.
Yeah.
Does that seem like a good idea to you?
Yes, I do. I think, you know, there has to be elements to it. It has to be bipartisan. It has to have the authority to get behind the scenes, subpoena and look at information, take testimony from people that don't want to give it, and get the whole record, and then make the report. That's what the 9/11 Commission did. That's what I think the Church Committee did. The successful committees have really been a great force for reform in America, and I think that this black hole that I described, we need to know a lot more about that.
Yeah, the Church Committee had, among the Republicans on it, were Howard Baker, who was Republican leader,
It had Barry Goldwater on it. Yeah. I mean, it was these weren't the.
We had, and that's the other thing. You need really good people, like Tom Kane mm-hmm. and Lee Hamilton of the 9/11 Commission. Terrific, because they set the right tone, and they had a staff that was bipartisan, and they worked as one staff. They tried to avoid becoming divided. They tried to keep that integrity, and they did. These are not easy things to do, and great care has to be made in how they're established. But I think America needs this cleansing once in a while.
We have a question in the back here, please.
Thank you for taking my question. This one is a little bit more about future policy and about economic and information security for our country. In the last 2 weeks, we've seen Google be forced out of China due to cyber attacks that seem to come from the Chinese government. And with China now being the largest economy in the world, more American corporations are going to be drawn to that market. Do you see the U.S. government playing a role in securing a level playing field for these corporations? And if so, a lot of these corporations have contracts with the U.S. government and information dealing with U.S. government contracts. How does the U.S. government go about protecting that information? And if both you gentlemen want to comment, since it's a future policy question,
well,
thank you.
Well, I think that's is already starting to rise as an issue, and my guess is it's going to continue to escalate as an issue. And the answer is that among the duties that the U.S. government has is to see that the international laws and rules are followed in trade, in protecting intellectual property, in preventing manipulation of currency, and other kinds of impediments to American commerce that are against the understandings. And that gets really difficult when you're dealing with a country with which you have a whole range of other serious issues to be resolved. We need China to deal with North Korea. We need China, if we can persuade them, in Iran. It would be a far better world if China would become a stakeholder in these issues rather than these more tactical approach that they take. Now, China is a police state, and China is trying to prevent, they're trying to have the wonders of high technology without the fundamentals of openness that it requires. It's not for nothing that most of these inventions occurred in America, because we are open democracy and they're all natural to us. And it's changing our society, and we accept that. But China does not accept those changes. And now, you know, they're manipulating their currency so that I read that the Chinese goods are maybe 30-35% cheaper than they should be. So it's like passing a law that will tax American products 35% and give that benefit to our competitors, in this case, China. I think currency manipulation is against the international monetary rules, and I think we should start raising those issues and start pressing China for change. Something's happened the last year or two about China. They're getting, their leadership is really the way they took on this issue. President Obama went over there, and they wouldn't even let him speak to an honest crowd. They picked the crowd for him. They wouldn't allow his speech to be seen on television. I went there as vice president. They even let me do that. They've never treated a president quite like that I can remember. Remember, they didn't do that to Clinton. They didn't do that to Bush. In the Copenhagen Environmental Summit, the Chinese were distinctly unhelpful over there, and they haven't done anything to help us on Iran. You know, I'm not looking for trouble with China. We got to handle this very, very carefully. But there are some issues there that I think we've put under the rug for too long. We got to start dealing a little more directly with it.
I want to come at this question a little bit another angle.
Okay.
You surprised some liberals when you were in the Senate and you took the lead in creating the budget process and what we know as reconciliation. And one of the arguments you made is that fiscal responsibility and protecting against inflation is essential for protecting those who have less, the poor and those who are struggling.
Yeah.
When you look at the fiscal situation that we have now, and I tend to see this, frankly, as primarily overhang from the last administration, though this administration is not responsible for it. Do you think the attitude or the resistance we're seeing in China is partly a reflection of the fact that they hold the cards for a lot of our debt and they're beginning to throw their weight around?
For at least 10 years, 15 years, we've had a deal going with China. We'll buy their goods, and they will borrow the money from them to do it. And we now owe them almost $2 trillion. And if you want a formula for national weakness, there's one to look at. So I think we're paying a price because we weren't disciplined enough in our own lives not to go for that. And we've got to work our way out from underneath that. But we are in a bind. We're still in a serious recession. I heard the news today. It's not at all clear we're out of this yet. A lot of people are hurting. Millions of people are threatened, lost their jobs, their homes, and so on. This is a serious and challenging moment. So I think we have to do two things. We have to keep stimulating the economy to get it started while we put in place credible long-term strategies for bringing the deficit down as soon as we've got enough oomph back in the economy to allow us to do it. I think that idea that was shot down the other day in the Senate of having a commission like the old Social Security Commission that would make specific decisions to how we would deal with this deficit that could be voted up or down by the Congress but had to be acted on was a good way to get this started. And we'll see what happens. But it is a real and tough problem.
Maybe we take one more question?
Yep.
Okay, one. And,
Thank you for this great evening. In fact, thanks to both of you. You started off talking about the filibuster and how it's getting very, very difficult to get things done. It seems like in the past there seemed to be so much more ability to compromise with our elected officials, and nowadays it seems to be trending towards, you know, you got to hold the line, no compromise. You show weakness if you compromise. I'd love to hear your thoughts on why you think that might be tending this way. Or better yet, why are we electing people that way?
Well, that's a good question to you. I think something happened in America. I don't think this is the normal. We are going to have political debate and train wrecks and so on. But I was listening to David Dernberger the other day, who's saying he's just very critical of the inability of the Senate to sit down and work out something serious on health care. He's an expert on that. And he said something's happened here where people don't compromise or bend anymore. I've got some candidates for why this is true, and it's only a guess. One is I think that the growth of the right-wing religious rhetoric where issues were converted from civil disputes to issues between good and evil. You don't compromise with evil. That's had some bearing on it. I think that the big money in American politics, and with the Supreme Court decision, I'm worried, really worried about more of it. I think that all that money slopping around the political system, look at the money that went to the Health Committee recently and the Finance Committee and these candidates, it rigidifies the public process. They get kind of locked in and they can't move. And I think that's another thing that's happened. I don't know. When I was there, a lot of the fun of being in the Senate was putting coalitions together, Republican and Democrat, so you could go to the American people with an American answer. That's gone now. And it's really a grievous cost to the American people. I don't see any movement yet. That's why I talk about filibuster reform. Something's got to give here. Right now, nothing's happening.
I have a question in the back. Do our continual questions seem like a filibuster on our part here?
Yeah. Yeah.
We can't let you go. Let's go back. Let's go to the back.
Mr. Vice President, as sort of a follow-on to the last question, I was wondering if you thought that there might be any wisdom to term limits for the legislative branch, that might take away some of the impetus to simply want to get reelected as opposed to find solutions.
Well, we've experimented with it. California has term limits. I think term limits guarantees that the legislature will be really weak. The executive branch and career officials, they'll be around for a long time. But I don't think what you're trying to do is get people's attention. And I think this creates something, may have got their attention, but then they can't get anything done. The biggest basket case in America today is California. They're $42 billion in debt. They're cutting $800 million this year out of their university system. They can't raise any taxes without a two-thirds vote. Most of what's in the budget has been put in there by adopted resolutions that people have voted on. But so the legislature, many times proposals were adopted 30 years ago. They have no way of dealing with their problem. That's why they issued written script here a couple months ago. I don't like the idea behind term limits because it suggests that there's something inherently wrong with a person who chooses public service as a lifetime career. Somehow I don't like that idea.
Larry, you want the last word?
Thank you. I want to thank Mr. Mondale for joining us tonight and also take this opportunity to thank him for being a master instructor. I think we've now had over 600 students to our classes, and at the University of Minnesota, we really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
we want to thank both of you. Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.